Today is Friday, April 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Australia calls for reform at the World Health Organization.
What happens at the upper echelons of these organizations and how they operate, I think, is in need of change.
Plus, the challenges Africa faces meeting equipment needs during the pandemic.
And to be acutely aware of just how unprepared the continent is.
And the coronavirus threatens to upend Muslim traditions dating back 1,500 years. Those stories and more are next. Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker shows there have been over 2.7 million confirmed cases of the disease globally. COVID-19 caused nearly 200,000 deaths. The United States has the most cases with at least 869,000 and about 50,000 deaths attributed to the disease. Spain is a distant second with over 213,000 cases and more than 22,000 deaths. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said his country will cooperate with like-minded countries to change the World Health Organization. Morrison said although Australia continues to support the agency's work in the Pacific region, it agrees with the United States that the WHO needs to be reviewed.
What happens at the upper echelons of these organizations and how they operate, I think, is in need of change. And Australia will continue to advocate for that change with like-minded countries who share our concerns. What ultimate decision the United States ultimately takes on funding will be a matter for them. We will certainly want to see an improved set of arrangements at the WHO, and we'll continue to push for that through the forums as a participant, as a member, as someone who understands and publicly states the value of the work that it does on the ground.
U.S. President Donald Trump directed his administration to freeze WHO funding, saying it did not give adequate early reports on the coronavirus. The WHO announced the launch of a private solidarity rescue fund it hopes will allow private individuals, corporations, and institutions to donate directly to global response efforts. Africa has yet to see the worst of the pandemic that has devastated New York, Italy, and Spain, but the outlook for the continent may be grim. The World Health Organization says Africa has only 5 beds in intensive care units per 100,000 people, while Europe has 4,000 ICU beds per 100,000 people. There are only 2,000 ventilators spread out over 41 African countries. The others have none. Now to learn more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to John Campbell, a senior fellow of African Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He began by summarizing his impression of the African leaders and policymakers he's spoken to.
They tend to be absolutely scared to death. They have seen the horrific pictures coming out of northern Italy, but also out of the public hospitals in New York. And they tend to be acutely aware of just how unprepared the continent is for the onset of the virus.
But unlike New York and most of Italy, most Africans are quite poor.
Yes, and that changes everything. If you're talking about pre-existing conditions, for example, HIV, high blood pressure, diabetes, the whole host of issues that can make the disease fatal.
Not to mention pneumonia, of course, which is another big killer on the continent.
It is indeed. In fact, most of the time, it is the killer that's connected to the virus. I mean, that's what people die of.
Do you think that the devastation that you anticipate in Africa will create more conflict or terrorism there?
Yes. Certain of the jihadi radical groups operating in the Sahel, some of their preachers have said, now is the time to strike. The goal is the destruction of the secular state, and what we are seeing is the inability of the secular state to protect its people. So yes, I would anticipate there will be an upsurge in that kind of terrorism.
Any rays of light on the continent, models that give you some hope?
It's very interesting what has happened in South Africa. The Ramaphosa government imposed a social distancing and quarantine regime not unlike that in South Korea or in Thailand. And in South Africa, at least for the time being, it appears to be working. The curve is flattening. Here is the danger. The South African government made too little provision for the economic consequences of quarantining amongst the poorest part of the population, for whom quarantining and social distancing and the other strategies that are used in the developed world are impossible. How do you practice social distancing when you are involved in an informal economy that is based on face-to-face contact? How do you carry out hand washing in an environment in which water is so short that you buy it and you use it for drinking? Further, enforcement of quarantining by the security services has been pretty rough. Unless the government is able to address both of these issues, then public support for what would appear to be a strategy that is working is likely to evaporate.
What might the United States do to help Africa?
Two things. We're really, really good at famine relief, at the transport of immense amounts of food very quickly to places that badly need it. And much, particularly in West Africa, but also elsewhere, much of Africa is now in a pre-famine situation. The second thing we're really good at is building very quickly field hospitals. It's what the military did in the last weeks of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. Huge military field hospitals that we put up in Liberia and other places. And the Africans didn't forget it. It was interesting to watch how the African in the streets views on the Africa Command, AFRICOM, flipped from seeing it as somehow or another an example of U.S. neocolonialism to actually understanding what it was intended for.
John Campbell is a senior fellow for African Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York via Zoom. The coronavirus outbreak threatens to upend Muslim traditions that have been practiced for almost 1,500 years. The pandemic has forced many governments to order unprecedented restrictions on movement, gathering, and collective prayers. VOA's Aisha Tanzim brings us this story of the world's nearly 2 billion Muslims and how they will spend their holiest month of Ramadan, which begins this week.
Kaaba, the holiest of sites for Muslims, usually teeming with worshippers from around the world during Ramadan, is empty. Mosques in Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Islam, have closed their doors to the faithful. Even Masjid al-Nabawi, the mosque of Muhammad, the Muslim prophet, is closed. The government has ordered everyone to pray at home. Muslims around the world are grappling with a similarly grim reality. Their holiest month, usually marked with communal feasts and congregational prayers, will be spent trying to keep their fellow humans at a distance. Their mosques will remain empty, as seen during a special night of prayers pre-Ramadan.
Our mosque used to be overflowing at night. People worshipped all night long. This time, I was the sole worshipper on my prayer mat. No one else was around.
Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, one of the most senior leaders of Shiite Islam, has told his followers to offer their prayers in solitude during the month of fasting. The closure of houses of worship is also expected to affect many of the less fortunate. During Ramadan, many mosques turn into soup kitchens for the poor as individuals or groups organize charity tables. Not this year, as Islam El-Sharbani told us via phone from Cairo.
In the mosque, we used to prepare iftar the evening meal for the people who couldn't afford it. We also prepared Ramadan food bags and financial aid to the poor people. With the current crisis, we will decrease somehow, but we hope for the good.
Many are trying to keep the spirit of giving alive through other means.
This year, we cannot organize a charity table, so we have increased food delivery at home because a lot of people have been impacted with this pandemic. Until now, we have delivered more than 2,000 bags of groceries. We will continue this throughout Ramadan.
While many countries have limited intercity travel, the most populous Muslim country, Indonesia, has banned travel altogether for Ramadan. Tens of millions of people wishing to leave big cities for their hometowns will have to spend the holidays away from family. In some Muslim countries, like Pakistan and Afghanistan, governments have bowed to pressure from clergy to keep mosques open, although with safety guidelines. Health officials worry the guidelines will be hard to implement. The day after Ramadan ends is one of the most festive Muslim holidays called Eid al-Fitr. Many Muslim countries have already banned collective Eid prayers and subsequent festivities. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
And still to come...
Two people is more dangerous than one, 10 is more dangerous than two, 100 is more dangerous than 10... So it's all along a continuum, but once you get up to 50,000, 70,000, 100,000 for something like college football here in the United States in some stadiums, that's an enormous amount of risk to be taking on.
You're listening to VOA News.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2018, a pair of astronomers discovered that an asteroid sharing Jupiter's solar orbit, but doing so in the opposite direction, was not originally a part of our solar system. Elena Mordice of the Sao Paulo State University and Fatih Namouni from the French National Center for Scientific Research determined the asteroid formed around another star, which billions of years ago resided in the same cluster as our sun. The scientists suggested that the relatively closeness of the stars at the time, along with their and their planet's gravitational forces, allowed for the exchange of asteroids from each other's systems. In a new study published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, the two astronomers have identified a population of 19 asteroids with interstellar origins, orbiting the sun between our solar system's giant planets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. European stock markets fell slightly Friday, with investors disappointed by the lack of details about an emergency fund the bloc's leaders agreed on as evidence grew of the global damage wrought by the coronavirus crisis. Now, to get the latest details, I spoke with reporter Nicolas Pinault via WhatsApp in Paris.
Before this meeting, everybody was quite skeptical because divisions were very important among European leaders. And we have to say, we have to admit that after the meeting, this video conference, divisions remained. This was the sentence, the admission from President Emmanuel Macron when he talked to reporters from Paris. The French president said differences continue between EU governments over whether the fund should be transferring grant money or simply making loans. You know, we talk a lot about the two main positions within the EU, which is giving money to states or, lending money to states. And right now, you still have divisions. I think it's quite important to mention that the European Central Bank Governor, Christine Lagarde, made a speech during this visual conference, and she told the leaders that the pandemic could cut between 5% and up to 15% of Eurozone economic output, so which is quite important. On paper, they're still working on adding 1.6 trillion euros to help governments to face the pandemic. That was the position from the French government, Italy, Spain, but obviously some governments such as Austria and Germany and also the Netherlands, they would prefer grants. And on that opposition between these two blocks within the EU, they have not made any improvement. And so right now, discussions are still going to be ongoing to try to find a solution.
Right, because the gulf between grant versus loan is quite huge, and without a definitive solution, the EU is struggling how best to help its member states. So you mentioned that this is going to continue on for discussions for two more weeks. What do we know about any kind of positioning that the governments are going to do to try and come up with a consensus?
Yeah, so leaders tasked the European Commission, the EU executive, to present detailed proposal by May 6. And the Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, said the EU countries have so far handed out state aid worth $1.9 trillion. So it's a lot. And right now, what they're going to try to improve, it's maybe have to increase the EU budget to try to, you know, try to find a middle way for each camp, you know, to meet them halfway and try to agree on a solution. Because obviously, you're going to have to need a massive intervention from the EU, whether it's grants or it is loans. But they're going to have to do something about what's going on right now, as the economic situation is deteriorating a lot, not as worse as what you have right now in the United States. Because obviously, in the European Union countries, you have a safety net, but you know it's going to be ongoing. And many, many experts fear that we're going to go back to what happened almost 10 years ago during the crisis and the recession with countries with so many debts, such as Greece. And it took 10 years for them to recover. So that's the situation right now ongoing in the European Union.
That was Nicolas Pineau, a journalist, speaking to me from Paris, France. Turning to the United States and efforts to mitigate the financial burden of the pandemic, U.S. President Donald Trump signed the $484 billion relief package that passed the House of Representatives Thursday. The Senate approved the package earlier this week. It provides additional support for small business loans, helps hospitals, and expands COVID-19 testing. International media has been filled with reports that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is seriously ill, but nothing is known or has been confirmed about his condition. The speculation came after Kim was mysteriously absent from a key North Korean political anniversary last week. Cameroonian police used force to disperse Muslims praying at mosques at the start of the holy month of Ramadan Friday for violating government orders not to gather because of the coronavirus. Cameroon has confirmed at least 1,300 COVID-19 infections and 43 deaths, the hardest hit country in West Africa. In Olympic news, some infectious disease experts say organizers of the Tokyo Games must be flexible if a coronavirus vaccine is not found in time. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the Tokyo Olympics were pushed back 1 year. The Games are now scheduled from July 23rd to August 8th in 2021. VOA's Gwen Uten has more on a coronavirus vaccine and the Olympics.
Vaccines normally take years, if not decades, to develop. But scientists are attempting to create a coronavirus vaccine in a matter of months. Health experts are hoping a vaccine will become available by the middle of next year. But they admit the latter part of the year is a more likely scenario. And with the Tokyo Games now rescheduled for July of 2021, Olympic organizers are being advised to remain flexible. Zach Binney is a sports epidemiologist at Emory University in the United States. He says it would be wise to wait until a vaccine is developed before packing stadiums.
Two people is more dangerous than one, 10 is more dangerous than two, 100 is more dangerous than 10. So it's all along a continuum, but once you get up to 50,000, 70,000, 100,000 for something like college football here in the United States in some stadiums, that's an enormous amount of risk to be taking on without a vaccine.
And Benny says the Olympic Games pose a unique risk due to the influx of visitors from areas with high rates of infection.
Even next year, we're still probably going to have some areas of the world where outbreaks are popping up and there's more transmission than others. So that does make it uniquely risky because that increases the chance that you are bringing somebody in from an area where the infection is rampant, and so they may be more likely to bring it in and spread it around the Olympics. And the other element of risk is that everybody's going home once the Olympics are over, all over the globe.
Jason Kindrachuk is an infectious diseases expert at the University of Manitoba in Canada. He's optimistic that a vaccine will be developed in time for next year's games, but worries it might not be early enough to see if it actually works.
Not only do you have to get everybody vaccinated, but you also have to make sure that the vaccine is taken and that they have decent immune responses. So, I think and you want to get people vaccinated, not right at the point of the Olympics, but a little bit beforehand, so they build up that protective immunity. So I think all these things need to be weighed, and it may lead to some postponement or delay or further delay. But again, I think we have to get through at least probably the next couple of months to really understand whether or not the virus starts to have some resurgence in areas that lift up physical distancing measures. To see how susceptible we still are across the globe.
Dr. Kentaro Iwata is an infectious disease specialist at Kobe University in Japan. Last February, he criticized the Japanese government for the way it handled a coronavirus outbreak inside a cruise ship stationed near Tokyo. Now, Dr. Iwata questions the country's ability to control the virus leading up to next year's games.
Japan might be able to control this disease by next summer, and I wish we could, but I don't think that would happen everywhere on Earth. In this regard, I'm very pessimistic about holding Olympic Games in next summer, unless you hold Olympic Games in a totally different structures, such as no audience or very limited participations or such and such.
As health experts continue to debate whether the coronavirus outbreak will further delay the Olympic Games, Dr. Brian McCloskey says the argument itself is premature.
We've got 15 months more of planning and preparing for the Olympics in 2021. We've got 15 months to see how the outbreak evolves. So I think it's premature to say it's unrealistic. Clearly, having a vaccine would be extremely helpful, not just for the Olympics, but for all of us. But even without a vaccine, I think there are other mitigation measures we will look at to make sure we can run the game safely. So it's a challenge, but I'd say it's too soon to say it can't happen.
Dr. McCloskey is an expert on global health security and outbreak prevention. And he reminds us this is not the first time the Olympics have been staged during a health crisis.
We need to remember that previously we've run the Rio Olympics during a public health emergency for Zika. We ran the Vancouver Winter Olympics during the pandemic flu public health emergency. So we have experience where this can be done. This year for Tokyo, it got to the point where the amount of mitigation that would have been needed was more than we could ask the Japanese government to do when the Japanese government needed to be focusing on looking after its population. But that could well have changed by next year. So it's quite possible that the outbreak will be at a level where it's manageable without any particular risk. Or it may be that the vaccine arrives, it may be there's treatment available. So we just need to think through the options and not jump to too many conclusions too quickly.
As sports leagues and federations around the world continue to discuss how to resume during the pandemic, Tokyo organizers and the IOC are focused on delivering next year's games. In response to questions about any further delays, Olympic Committee spokesman Masa Takaya issued a statement that read in part, "We do not feel it is appropriate to respond to speculative questions with regard regard to countermeasures against COVID-19, Tokyo 2020 and the IOC have a framework for information exchange and are cooperating closely with the World Health Organization. We will continue to work deeply with relevant organizations and review all necessary countermeasures.
That was my colleague Gwen Uten. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic weekend.